You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 8 of a series in the letters of Peter. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. Finally, all of you be like-minded, be sympathetic, love one another, be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with insult, or insult with insult, or evil with evil, or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing. Because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil and their lips from deceitful speech. They must turn from evil and do good. They must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who is going to harm you if you are eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear their threats, do not be frightened. But in your hearts revere Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience, so that those who speak maliciously against your good behaviour in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. For it is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit. After being made alive, he went and made proclamation to the imprisoned spirits, to those who were disobedient long ago, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah, while the ark was being built. It is only a few people, 8 in all, were saved through fire. Through water, and this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. Not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a clear conscience towards God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand, with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. And this is a longer passage than we've looked at in the last couple of episodes. Hopefully we'll be able to get through it and do it justice. But it also contains one of the hardest portions of the New Testament to interpret or to understand. So I'll be doing well if we manage to get through it all in one episode. I just want to start actually where the passage finishes in verse 22. And the last part of verse 21, which talks about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand, with angels, authorities and powers in submission to him. This theme of submission, as I've said already, is important, and it has been important in chapter 2 and the first part of chapter 3. And we saw there that we are all to submit to the authorities, that slaves are to submit to their masters, that women or wives rather are to submit to their husbands. We'll see in chapter 5 that we are to submit to the elders of the church as well. But here is where this submission, of course, comes from. And we're reminded that every power and authority is subject to Jesus. He is Lord over all. He has risen. He has ascended. He's glorified. He's reigning at God's right hand. He is the Lord over every power and authority. And so our submission ultimately is to him. To go back to what Peter said earlier, is the shepherd and overseer of our souls. So that's the context for submission. But what Peter talks about here, in first of all in verse 8, is coming back to the theme of how we live in the church. And of course this is relevant in employment situations and in marriage and in our behaviour in society as well. We're to be known for being people who are like-minded. Christians are meant to think the same way. It's very sad whenever Christians argue and disagree over issues. And we need to learn better how to disagree well and to honour one another despite our disagreements. But we also need to learn how to move towards like-mindedness. We should accept that if there is a true way to think about some of the issues that we differ over, then what we're seeking is to move together towards the truth. But of course, the core things that unite us, the most important things in our faith, the core gospel truths of who Jesus is and our hope in his death and in his resurrection, and the need for faith in order to be saved and the core moral issues that the New Testament lays out. These are the things that Christians really ought to be like-minded about. There ought to be no difference of opinion. But we also need to be sympathetic, to love one another, to be compassionate and humble. The attitude of mind that we need more than anything else is humility and compassion for others. You see again this idea of humility. Well, if we recognize Jesus as Lord and sovereign over all, then that will breed humility in us, won't it? If we fear God, we will be humble people. We'll know what we are and what we aren't. Humility requires us both to know that we are not God, but also to know that we have value to God. You can't really be humble unless you're accepting God's judgment of you. And so there's that other dimension of pride, which is where we deny that we're of any value at all. We put ourselves down in a way that doesn't honour God's assessment of us. We're to be sympathetic and loving. Here are the core values that bind us together in the church, and we need to grow in these things, and we need to ask ourselves, is that what we're demonstrating towards one another? And if not, then how can we move towards it? And then there's this lengthy quote in verses 10 to 12 from Psalm 34, verses 12 to 16. Because Peter says, verse 9, and it's an echo very much of the teaching of Jesus, and you see it also in Paul in Romans 12, for example. Amazing how Paul and Peter both agree with each other on these issues, as the Spirit guides them, of course, and they're echoing the words of Jesus. Don't repay evil with evil or insult with insult. Revenge is not part of the behavior that a Christian should engage in. It's not something we should be even contemplating. We were called to repay evil with blessing, so that we may inherit a blessing. This theme of blessing, of course, goes right back to Abraham, and you can read about that in Genesis chapter 12 and 15 and 17 and so on, as God blesses Abraham and tells him that he will be blessed and he will be a blessing to others. This is what God has chosen a people for. He's chosen a people so that he can bless them, but that through them others can be blessed. So our duty is to bless others, even if they curse us, even if they insult us. Whoever would love life and see good days must keep their tongue from evil. The psalm inspires Peter here. God is watching the righteous. He's listening to our prayers. And then it continues on in verse 13. And now it's not so much about our behavior within the church, but our actions within the wider society. And again, the theme of suffering is going to resurface, because that's a very real situation that the Christians that Peter is writing to are facing. They're facing suffering. They're facing opposition. And so he says, who's going to harm you if you're eager to do good? Here again, this basic duty of Christians to do good to everyone. Now, who's going to harm people who are known for doing good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, and of course this is the challenge of 1 Peter, if we're going to suffer, let's make sure it's not because we deserve the suffering because we've done wrong. It's not because we should be rebellious or insubordinate. It's not because we should be difficult or contentious, argumentative, people who bite back, people who are easily offended, etc., etc. No, if we suffer, it should be because we have done what is right. But the reality in a fallen world is that sometimes even doing what is right will lead you to suffer. And so Peter acknowledges that that might happen. And he says, even if that does happen, and it was happening, it's not that he's finding it hard to believe that it would. He's just trying to challenge them to make sure that their behavior is right. But if that's the case, then we shouldn't, we are blessed. It's actually a sign of blessing when we suffer for what is right. Or it's a sign that God will bless us. This again echoes what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5 at the end of the Beatitudes, when he says, blessed are you if people persecute you. We are blessed by God. Suffering for doing right is not something we should be ashamed of, but a sign that God will bless us. And so Peter encourages them then with words from Isaiah. This time it's Isaiah chapter 8, verse 12, that he quotes. He says, "Do not fear their threats," or possibly, "Do not fear what they fear. Don't be afraid of the same." I mean, both of those are true, of course. We as Christians should not be afraid of the same things that non-Christians fear, whether that's death or loss, disease or loss of face. But also we shouldn't fear them and their threats. We shouldn't be frightened. And in the passage in Isaiah, it's well worth turning up and noticing this. Because in Isaiah 8, the passage continues to say this. Isaiah 8, verse 12, "Do not call conspiracy everything this people calls a conspiracy. Do not fear what they fear, and do not dread it." And listen now, verse 13. "The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread." So Peter is quoting that verse, verse 12, and then he breaks off before verse 13, or rather he takes verse 13 and he turns it around. Remember what it said back in chapter 2, verse 17, "Fear God." And when you fear God, you don't need to fear anything else. But the Lord is the one you're to fear. He's the one you're to regard as holy. Well, notice what it says. Turn back again to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15. "But in your hearts revere Christ as Lord." You notice it? Isaiah 8. "The Lord Almighty is the one you're to regard as holy." 1 Peter 3. "Revere Christ as Lord." Now, what does that say about who Jesus is? You see what Peter has done. He's taken an Old Testament passage about God and he's applied it to Jesus. This is one of a number of places in the New Testament where the writers do that. Sometimes people ask, well, does the New Testament teach that Jesus is God? And there are places that we can go to, John chapter 1 and John 8, and look at the things that Jesus said, the I am sayings and so on. And we can say, yes, Jesus is God, or some statements in Paul's letters like Philippians 2, that he didn't consider equality with God something to be grasped and so on. But there are also all of these implicit places that are right through the New Testament. And of course, the whole New Testament ends with Revelation, where the Alpha and Omega is revealed to be both Jesus and God. There's no question that Jesus is God, but Peter is saying, look, if you don't fear, if you revere Jesus as Lord, if Christ is really Lord in your heart and you acknowledge that and you belong to him and you are living under his lordship, and again, remember what it says at the end of the chapter, that every other power and authority is subject to him, then you don't need to fear anybody else. Nobody can do anything to you without his permission. And nobody, even if they take your life, can rob you of the inheritance that you have, because Christ is living and risen from the dead and you have a living hope. Do you believe that, brother or sister? Do I believe it? Preach it to yourself until it grips your soul and frees you from fear. And I say that as somebody who knows their share of fear. Believe me, I'm not hiding anything here. I'm not pretending. I'm not suggesting that it's always easy. But when we fear, we need to look to Jesus and set him apart as Lord and remember that we belong to him. But it's not just, Peter's not just giving them advice as to how they internally can cope with the opposition that they might face for being Christians. He also wants us to be proactive in then speaking about our faith. So he says, verse 15 continues, "Be prepared to give an answer." How prepared are you to give an answer, a reasoned defense of your faith, and especially of your hope, the living hope that you have because Jesus is risen from the dead? Now, first of all, you've got to be somebody who is known for hope. I mean, it ought to be that when people treat you badly, they see through the way you respond to them that you bless them. They see that they can't squash your hope. And so they're beginning to ask, why do you have such hope? Peter assumes that people will give you an opportunity. It may be that he has trials in mind here, people who are arrested and put on trial and asked why they believe the things they believe. But it may be in individual relationships. Certainly, as Christians, we ought to be looking for these kind of opportunities. Are you? Am I? When people notice something different in you, maybe you talk differently, you're less negative, you're more positive. Maybe there's just more of a smile on your face. Maybe you're kind to them and gentle to them. Maybe you're not hard and bigoted the way other people might be. Or maybe you're actively sowing seeds that provoke people to think. But when they ask you, are you ready to explain? Would you be able to explain the gospel? If you're not, if you don't feel confident in that, seek out help. Ask your pastor or minister. Maybe go to a course somewhere nearby. Or drop me an email if you live in Northern Ireland. Certainly, I'll be really happy to try and link you up with some opportunity to train or think this through. Be ready. Be prepared. But do it, Peter says, with gentleness. And here again, I'm afraid, I don't want to criticize, it's a really good translation, but the NIV has got this wrong. It says with gentleness and respect. And we've seen already in the last episode that respect was used earlier in the chapter, where it should say honor, about husbands' attitudes towards their wives. But now respect is being used to translate a different Greek word. It's the word fear. Now, I can understand why the translators did this, because Peter has already told us, don't be afraid of them. But you remember what he said in chapter 2, verse 17, fear God. And Isaiah chapter 8 that he's quoted from says, fear the Lord. And so I think it should be fear here, but it's not fear of them, it's fear of the Lord. And so we should always keep our fear of God, but also gentleness towards them. We're not trying to batter people over the head. We're not trying to heap condemnation on them. We are gentle towards them as people who are loved by God. But we need to keep a clear conscience, verse 16, so that there is no accusation. This is a theme right throughout Peter, that we are known for good behaviour, and it's only if we do good that we should suffer, not for doing wrong. And then Peter develops this theme of suffering. It's better to suffer for doing good than for doing evil, verse 17. And then he brings us to Christ again. This is what he did before, back in chapter 2, I think it is, when he told the slaves that if they suffer from cruel masters at the end of chapter 2, it is, and they should look to Jesus as their example, who suffered without complaining. And here again, it's Jesus, the righteous, suffering for the unrighteous. He's our example of righteousness. He's the one who certainly didn't suffer for any wrong that he did, but he did it not just as an example to us so that we suffer well, but to bring us to God. You could build up these passages from Peter in chapter 2. It was about him bearing our sin, taking our place and taking our sin and the punishment that should be ours. Here it's now through his death bringing us to God. Put to death in the body but made alive in the spirit. And then there's these difficult verses, verses 19 to 21. Let's just walk through them and I'll suggest some thoughts about them. After being made alive, so after his resurrection, in other words, or if you look at the footnote, it could be not after his resurrection, but before it, because it could read the end of verse 18, but being made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and made proclamation. So this could be something that happened before Jesus was raised again from the dead, or it could be something that happened whenever after his resurrection, and perhaps even after his ascension. But whenever it was, or in fact, it could also be something that happened earlier, because if it says it happened in the Spirit, then it could be the Holy Spirit who did it. So there are three possibilities about when this might have been. Let's read on to see which of those is most likely. He says, he went and made proclamation to the imprisoned spirits, to those who were disobedient long ago, when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being saved. Are being built, rather. So these are people who were alive in the time of Noah, but are now imprisoned spirits. So when did Jesus make a proclamation to them? Well, it could be he did it through the Spirit while they were alive on earth. So now they are imprisoned spirits, but they weren't at the time when Jesus did it. And it's talking about the Holy Spirit, perhaps through Noah, or just through bringing conviction to them, preaching to them, but they disobeyed. They rejected it. That's one possibility. Or it could be that either after his death, but before his resurrection, or after his resurrection, and maybe after his ascension, Jesus then went to these spirits and proclaimed the truth to them. So in other words, they died disobedient to God, but Jesus went and proclaimed to them. And what did he proclaim? Well, it doesn't tell us. It could be that it means he gave them an opportunity to repent and to be saved, or it could mean that he just proclaimed the truth to them, the truth by which they would be judged, that it became clear to them that when they had rejected God in their day, they had rejected him. Now, we don't know which of those options is true, so we can't speculate too much. We can't build anything. People have done that or tried to do that, and they've suggested on the basis of these verses, for example, that maybe people who die without hearing about Jesus have an opportunity after death to be saved. That at the final judgment they'll have an opportunity to be saved, or maybe once they die, before just before they go to Hades, the place of the dead, they're given an opportunity to be saved. Other people say, well, no, that's not true, because Hebrews says it's appointed to people once to die and then the judgment. Doesn't sound like you have an opportunity after death. So there are different schools there, and I wouldn't be dogmatic about it. Of course, I would think it would be wonderful to believe that people might have an opportunity to be saved after death. Why would we not think that was wonderful? But this is very scant evidence to build that on, because the verses could be translated in different ways. I think from the second part of verse 20, it becomes easier, because then it says in the ark, only a few people, 8, were saved through water. And you notice how Peter treats this as if it's true historically. He doesn't leave it open for this being a myth. The salvation of 8 people through the waters by in the ark. That's also important in 2 Peter. It says something about how Peter and the other New Testament writers, and of course Jesus himself, viewed the Old Testament, and how we should read it as well. But only 8 were saved through water, and this water, verse 21, symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. So here's what Peter says about baptism. You see it in Acts that Peter preached that people needed to be baptized. We see throughout Acts that it was the common practice. Paul also makes reference to it in some of his letters, particularly in Romans. Here Peter is talking about baptism bringing salvation. But he doesn't say that we are saved by being baptized. It's not as if baptism itself cleans us, and it's certainly not about the cleaning of the body. You know, we don't get baptized. And I have to say, I think it's immersion that's in view here. I think that's the only mode of baptism that the New Testament describes. And in fact, it's inherent in the meaning of the word itself, which means to immerse or to submerge. The Greek word that's transliterated as baptism means that, or baptize, baptizo. The Greek word means to immerse. And I think it's only really baptism of believers by immersion that's in the New Testament. But that's a subject in itself. I can't go into that in depth, but if you're interested in the reasoning why, just email me and I'll try and get back to you. But it's not that the baptism itself, it's not that the water saves us, it's not the act of being baptized, but it's the pledge of a clear conscience towards God. In other words, baptism is an action which demonstrates and seals and makes public something that is personal and internal and inward, which is to do with our conscience. It is an expression of our faith in Jesus. It is an expression of our inclusion in his people, amongst his people, the church. And it's an expression of a clear conscience, the fact that we have been made clean through faith in Jesus, and that we intend to continue to live for him. But this only works. Baptism only saves us by the resurrection of Jesus. In other words, again, it's not the baptism itself that saves us, but it's the fact that Jesus died to bring us to God and rose again and now reigns at God's right hand, so that he continues to bring people to God who have faith in him. I think when you look at it, this is a wonderful passage. How it moves from a wonderful declaration about how we should live in the church, and how we should overcome evil with good, and then how we should face opposition and seek opportunities in the midst of that to share about our faith with people who don't know Jesus. But then re-centering us on the person of Jesus himself and what he has accomplished and his position as Lord. I don't know what the challenge for you is. Maybe it's about how you live with your brothers and sisters. There may be forgiveness that you need to go and seek. There may be ways that you need to go and show the like-mindedness and compassion. It may be that you're realizing that God is giving you opportunities to share with others, that where you have faced opposition, where people have given you a hard time for being a Christian, you've kind of withdrawn instead of looking for the opportunity to speak. It could be that you need recentered on Jesus. It might be that you need to come to him for the first time in faith, or maybe you are a believer, but you haven't been baptized yet. And you need to go and be baptized to pledge, make this pledge of from a clear conscience towards God. But let me leave you again with this beautiful vision in verse 22 of Jesus enthroned at God's right hand with angels, authorities and powers, and my heart, and I hope yours, and my life, and I trust your life in submission to him.